This is Dottie Pepper, and you're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening to this edition of Radio Golf Show, again in English. New York, London, Paris, Munich, everybody talk about pop music. We have been heard in 48 countries around the world, which must be a record for a German golf podcast, for an obscure German golf podcast. But it's guests like the gentleman we have on today that lets us be heard in 48 countries around the world. I'm Frank Forster, and Mark, would you please do the introduction this evening, sir?
Yes, good evening. This is a slightly tougher one than usual, because I'm not really sure how to introduce today's guests. I could either start listing some of his most important works, that would take ages. I could list topics he has published books on. I could quote others, writers and golfers alike, telling us how influential and inspiring his texts are. I could list the names of magazines he has not only worked for, but whose reputation as brands he has helped to build. Or I could just mumble his name and ask how he's doing. I think I'll just do all of it. He's an author of one of the most compelling books about the Masters, about Augusta National and its founder, Clifford Roberts. He published his best-selling book, The Chosen One, on Tiger Woods in 2001 and has repeatedly written about his own adventures in the game. In doing so, he has given voice to the rest of us, the hundreds and thousands of weekend warriors and Wednesday slicers, holiday hookers, and three putters. He's written books about hearing and deafness, finance, houses, about the Colorado River, scientific innovations, and one called Green Metropolis on sustainability in 2009, I believe it was, long before everyone in the marketing world started using the word. Our friend Dottie Pepper told us a few weeks back that she reads the aforementioned book about the Masters tournament once a year as part of her meticulous preparation for her on-course broadcasting. And German golf writer Stefan Maywald spoke of his stories in Hit and Hope as some of the best golf literature you can get. Working as a staff writer for The New Yorker, he has recently given us articles and long reads on a wide array of subjects such as cheating at bridge and sordid involvement in golf, film composers, grammar, and loads of other stuff. I'm not going to go on about his work for Golf Digest, but I'll mention two things. His piece about golf and skin cancer from a few years back is a great but rather frightening read. And he's played golf with Trump and written about it. So enough of this. Ladies and gentlemen, dear listeners, meine Damen und Herren, David Owen. David, how do you do and how do you do it?
Hey, great. I feel terrific. I'm glad to be on the show. That's even I was impressed by all those things you said.
Yeah, we do have a way with our guests.
We'll see. I'll try to live up to it.
So you've been on the New Yorker for how many years now?
It's now 33 years. I started writing for the New Yorker pretty much the same year I started playing golf. I took up golf late. I was 36 and had this experience of going from one day basically never thinking about golf to the next day thinking about nothing else. And it's kind of continued since then. I don't know what happened. It was a friend of my wife's and mine invited me out to play nine holes, and I knew nothing about it. I had some old golf clubs that had belonged to my brother, and I took them, and I was I was terrible. I was just horrible. And I knew immediately that it was something I wanted to do. And I had just finished a book about something. And when I got home, I called my agent. I said, I know what I want my next book to be. I want it to be about golf. And because I realized, and what turned out to be true, that if I was writing about it, I would be able to have many experiences that I would not be able to have otherwise as a golfer. So I immediately went to golf school and wrote about it for Esquire magazine. And I went to Ireland and wrote about it for the Atlantic Monthly, or went to Scotland, wrote about it for the Atlantic Monthly. And then I showed those two articles to Golf Digest, and they sent me immediately to Ireland. And I played in a pro-am. We almost won with the Disney Classic. It was 3 days of pro-am. And all these, I felt kind of bad about it because my brother, he's 7 years younger, he's played golf since he was a little kid. He was a captain of his high school and college golf teams. And he was living in New York and never getting to play golf. And here I was, you know, with golf clubs of his. He said, you know, oh, by the way, I'm off to Scotland tomorrow to play the Old Course, and all these things that he had, you know, had never done himself. And it's been kind of like that. My arrangement with the New Yorker isn't terribly interested about golf. At one time it was. Herbert Warren Wind was the premier thinking person's golf journalist, and these endless pieces that would appear months later. But it's not, the New Yorker isn't like that anymore, and the current editor is not very interested in golf. And so I had this sort of two halves of my brain. There was the New Yorker half and the golf half. And I always arranged my contract with the New Yorker so that I was never really committed to anything, because I always wanted to be, when Golf Digest called up and said, oh, by the way, could you play all 14 courses where the Open Championship has been played in one trip? And I said, sure, you know, I'll take off tomorrow. And or can you play would you be willing to play we're publishing I think every other year, top 100 courses in the United States. Would you be willing to play the top 10 and write about it? And because we don't know what those top 10 will be, you'll have to play probably 15. And
can't do.
So, so I did those things, but I had to be able to tell, you know, the editors of the New Yorker, no, I can't do whatever you want me to do, because I'm going to do this other thing that you're not very interested in.
There's this saying about people who get gripped by golf at a rather late age that they sort of get totally addicted to it. I'm not sure who said that. It was a famous writer. I can't remember. It might have even been when you just can't pull yourself out of it.
You can't. And then you start thinking, you're this ticking clock, you know, I'm 36, you know, how many decades do I have left? How long am I going to be able to do this? I'm about to turn 68, and I'm, you know, I feel like I'm still okay. Even maybe slightly, you know, it changes. The mix of what I can do changes, but I haven't felt really impaired by age yet as a golfer.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because technology keeps you long, doesn't it?
It does. Technology has helped a lot. It's helped a huge amount. And it also kind of keeps you, my friends and I, we always walk. So it's what I get for exercise is from playing golf. But it is interesting. There aren't that many, I think there, for most people, there aren't that many things that they do where they think, geez, I've only got 40 years left to, you know, go to work or whatever it is. They don't feel that way. But golf, you just think, I wish. The advantage about starting late is that you're not haunted in the way. I know some people who were very good when they were very young, and it's hard on them because as they get older and they can't get the ball as far, they can't do this, they can't do that, it's they're depressed. And whereas if you start late, it's not a great fall off from what you were when you're young, because you were nothing when you were young.
Well, not wanting to frustrate you, I can tell you I started with 30 and I played some good golf, actually, and I've totally lost my swing and I can't even hit a ball anymore. So it's it can deteriorate, and then you start taking your swing out, you know, and then you
back together. Mine did when I was in my 40s, and I got this assignment was suggested by Golf Digest. It was to have a midlife makeover. So as I turned 50, I went to, and I had a spent some time with a teacher and got new clubs and got new clothes. I went to visit Bob Rotella, the sports psychologist, and it was transformative. I went from my swing had turned into this sort of weak slice, old man slice. And the teacher I went to, Shelby Futch in Scottsdale, Arizona, suddenly I'm hitting these big draws and everything. And he fixed my swing, and it didn't take very long. And it completely changed my life. He told me a story. It's an interesting story. A woman had given her husband, her husband had been a golfer. He was getting older. It was getting terrible. He was depressed. She said he was horrible to live with. She couldn't stand him anymore. And so she gave him a week of lessons with this guy that I had lessons with. And she told him, you have to say that it's not refundable. And he said, well, of course it's refundable if he doesn't like it. She said, no, you just have to tell him that it's not, because if he thinks it is, he won't go through with it. But he's such a cheapskate that if you tell him it is, he will. And by the end of that period of time, that week, whatever it was, his life had changed, and it not only rescued his golf game, it rescued his marriage. So his wife sent champagne to my teacher and all this kind of stuff. So I think
I'm going to ask you for his name later.
Right. It's Shelby Futch. She's terrific. I don't know if he bought the John Jacobs golf schools. He used to run the Golf Digest golf schools, and he owns a bunch of golf courses in Scottsdale. And he does something. He said every teacher should be a student, because you should know what it's like to have to learn something that you're not very good at. So he's an acrobatic flyer. He has these little planes, and he does all this, you know, stuff like that. So anyway,
so that's really interesting guy. So he teaches golf and he studies flying.
Right. And he says that being a student helps him be a better teacher.
So. Frank?
First of all, David, hello from me also, and thanks for being on the show. I'm going to take a quick shortcut here and talk to David Owen, the scientist, because the one thing I'm most interested in is the beer draw hypothesis. Mm. The word on the street is that you have discovered something, that there's a certain number of beers that turn a strong fader of the ball into a drawer of the ball.
Right. It was really a slice. A companion of mine discovered this on a trip, that the difference between a slice and a draw is a certain number of beers. And you see it with golfers where, you know, once they start to get a little lubricated when they're playing, the tension goes out of their arms. They're not thrashing anymore, and they kind of loosen up and they swing out, and the ball not only goes farther, but it flies beautifully. And so that was the origin of the beer draw hypothesis. And I mentioned it in passing in a piece that I wrote for Golf Digest. And then a few years later, Golf Digest, this is another reason that I didn't want to have too binding a contract with the New Yorker. I had lunch with two editors at Golf Digest and said, we'd like to test the beer draw hypothesis. We're wondering if we could send you and three of your friends to Las Vegas for a week to test the effect of alcohol on the golf swing. And so I picked three friends from home, and we started drinking really at the airport, and didn't stop until we were home. And what we found, what we drank an extraordinary amount of alcohol. And what we found was that our games did improve. We hit the ball farther. We putted better. We were up to a certain point, and then there's a point where you kind of fall off a cliff. There was we noticed the problem in bunker, where we not only had trouble getting the ball out of the bunker, we had trouble getting ourselves out of the bunker, and because we'd had so much to drink.
I imagine that window closing quickly.
Was this a test to, you know, did you stay drunk for the whole week, or how long you were there? Or was this like, okay, we're going to drink two beers before every round and see how many beers we need to turn, you know, turn the fade into a draw? Or was it just like, okay, we'll just go there and drink all the time and just stay drunk for a week? Was that like,
well, there's someone did point out that there was a flaw in the experiment, was that there was no control. But what we did was we had a
no control, no driving.
there were guys wearing white lab coats, and they had clipboards, and there was a golf cart with a huge garbage can lashed to the back of it, filled with ice and filled with beer. And that drove followed us around, and people with the clipboards would write down how much we were drinking, and we weren't really paying any attention to them. And we play part of the this experiment was a 9-hole scramble that the four of us played against. It was Jimmy Kimmel and Adam Carolla, who at the time were The Man Show on TV, and Cousin Sal from that show, and then Carson Daly from MTV. So those were our opponents, and we annihilated them. They arrived. I think they arrived drunker than we got. We drank in 9 holes. I think I drank 14 beers, and we had a couple of Bloody Marys at lunch and all this. And at the end, Kimmel lay on his back on the ground, put a tee in his mouth, a tee to ball in his mouth, and let me. We were both completely drunk. Hit a pitching wedge. Off his face. I have a picture of that ran in Golf Digest. I should have used it as a Christmas card.
Testing the balance of the
game. We really did that.
We really did that.
It's not a joke. It wasn't set up. You know, come on. You know,
He said, no. You can see the ball in the photograph. And I kind of came over the top too. You could say, the ball isn't really, it's following a.
So you were swinging a relatively heavy piece of metal on a very thin shaft at the head
of
someone lying on the floor, and you were drunk.
Later, a multimillionaire television star, and it was all put at risk by this day. And one of my buddies who died just last year, but he took, I think it was Cousin Sal's shoes. He took them and threw them into a water hazard. We were pretty lit up, and then. When we had a rented minivan, we were go back to our hotel, and one of my buddies wanted to drive. He said, no, I'm perfectly fine. And then a minute later, he was asleep in the back seat of the van. But that night at our hotel, we were all sort of too drunk to stand. That night at our hotel, we went out and played. We had steaks and drank bourbon and played blackjack. So it was kind of now what the interesting. An interesting result of this trip was that two of the four of us in my group quit drinking altogether within 6 months of the end of it. And I still haven't had a drink since then. Part of it was the trip was one of the reasons. What struck both of us was that we were kind of appalled at how much we had been able to drink and still, you know, kind of function, and decided that it couldn't possibly be a good thing. And so we both quit. I also quit smoking cigarettes. So it had this cascade of benefits that came.
So what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, right?
All the bad habits stayed in Vegas. It was a great experience. And I was lucky that there were people there from Golf Digest who were taking notes, because I wasn't really paying attention.
Sounds like a Hunter S. Thompson story, doesn't it? You know,
it was great. And Kimmel said, one of the guys in my group, who's we call Barney, the third tee.
It's not Kimmel, his name, but just call him Barney.
It's Brandon, but we call him Barney. Kimmel and Daly and those guys hadn't really been paying too much. They'd been a little standoffish, but on the third tee, Barney farted, just ripped a really loud fart. And Kimmel said, if you'd asked me before we teed off, what are the odds that one of them will fart before one of us? I would have said 1,000,000 to 1. And after that, we were pals.
Well, I just for the record, I believe the number of beers is 1.5, if I remember correctly. In this very, very cool book called My Usual Game, where there's a bunch of stories. That's one of them. I want to talk to you about whether wives should play golf or not.
The difficulty with the beer draw hypothesis, you're probably, it's a beer and a half before you tee off, and then maintain through the course around that level of intoxication. And the difficulty is that once you've had 1.5, you don't want to maintain it. So it takes a huge amount of discipline to just keep the blood alcohol level at exactly that level.
Well, the book is I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I learned a lot from, you know, because I've been on those golf trips that you talk about. To Myrtle Beach and I've played at Pine Valley, and you know, this is just a wonderful book that you can open at any page and it kind of grabs you. So yeah, thanks for that book, by the way. My Usual Game, it's called, and it's available in Germany via Amazon.
It is, actually.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. You order it tonight, I'll be there tomorrow.
Let's talk about another books, because there is something that I've been leaving. I haven't completely finished reading the master's book you wrote, I have to admit, but it's, you know, from the first page on, it's so full of insights and there's so much information in there, so many stories, that one, you know, one can hardly imagine how you really went about writing that. You know, can you just elaborate, because it is full of all these details about Mr. Roberts, as he's called, and it's breathtaking. Some of it is really, really interesting. What you found out. How did that work with the club?
It was like one of the lucky breaks of my life. It was great. I loved that project. It was so much fun. And what happened was that the guy who was the mule, you know, barefoot behind a mule, and became a billionaire. He was the chairman of the club, and he began to worry that all the members who had actually known Clifford Roberts, the co-founder with Bobby Jones of the club and the tournament, they would, you know, all the guys who had actually known Roberts would die, and that all that would be left about Roberts would be the stories that sports writers tell, which are, it, like, sports writers are the laziest journalists anywhere, and what they tend to do is they tend to tell and retell the same stories that they get from other people. And what is often the case is that the real story, they have this idea that they've improved anecdotes by, you know, that the anecdotes are better than the whatever the truth,
the true story. Yeah,
very often the true story is much more interesting. So yeah. Anyway, Stevens wanted somebody to write a book for the members that would be about Roberts, that they could have at the club, and they could sort of educate members. And he asked the editor of Golf Digest, who he would suggest, and he asked Peter Dobreiner, the late British golf writer, who he would, and they both suggested me. And so Stevens flew me down to Little Rock, and I met him in his office and stayed in his house, and we agreed that he decided I was okay, and we talked about
Yeah, I think we're back.
Yeah, we're all right.
Okay, we're all right. Sorry, David.
Oh yeah. Anyway, so I flew to Little Rock and met him, and I passed. You know, he approved of me. Even though the only thing I'd written about, I'd played Augusta National on a Golf Digest assignment, playing the best courses in the country, and the thing that I had said about it was that the members. A number of the members looked as though they were sitting around awaiting word of the outcome of the Civil War. That was the only thing I'd written about it. But but anyway, so we were okay, and we talked about he talked about what the fee would be, and I said that's fine. I said, but Mr. Stevens, what I'm really interested in is playing that golf. Mm-hmm. It a lot, and he said, you can play it as often as you want to, and so I did. So for more than 2 years while I was working on the book, and then a time after, I would go down, I would stay at the club, various places at the club, as Stevens's guest. I would eat with him in the dining room. I had, you know, I would work in the morning. I had two people who were helping me. We had an office that we worked in, and that I would have lunch, and then I would go to the driving range, and my caddy would be there with my golf clubs, and we would go out and play golf. And if there were, I'd play with
Frank. I think we're losing him.
Yeah, we're kind of losing you every once in a while. You're cutting out. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know why.
But yeah, just keep going.
Okay.
So, just to recap, you were basically living as a member on course. It was basically you could go out and play. You'd have your lunch. You'd have your offer. It's like the best job ever.
It was. It totally was. And it was better than being a member, because unlike a member, I couldn't take a guest, although I did once. but I, so people weren't sucking up to me to get me, you know, to get me.
They were just jealous.
Right. So, and I would go, and then I began to seem like part of the furniture there, because there was, there would be a tour pro there who was coming to practice for the Masters. There was no member to play for him. And even if you've won the Masters, you still have the rules require you to play with a member. Well, there was no member available to play for him. So they had me, they sent me out with him, you know, you go out and play with him. So I went out and played with him and his father, and the mid amateur champion came to practice.
Was it Seb Strucker?
No, Spider Miller. It was Spider Miller came, and he's a beer distributor, so it fit in very well. Spider and I, he's a total golf nut. The weather was terrible. We went out, we played 54 holes. Then we went out and we did what he called sampling product. We went out and drank beer. And then the next morning we went up and we played again. And I was, there was another time, there was a large group of people, it was members and their sons. They came and they had an annual trip where they played golf all day, and then they played gin in the clubhouse all night. And they were one guy short. And I was sitting in the golf shop with the two pros, and these guys, we're one guy short in our foursome. And I said, I'll play. And so, you know, they sent me out. There was another day when they were short. The place was full of members and guests, and they didn't have enough caddies. And I said, I'll caddy. And so I got the white coveralls and green hat. And I still have my hat. I should have saved my coveralls. I didn't. Anyway, I got to caddy for that group and see what that was like. So it was great. And then not only the golf part, but the work was tremendous, because the club has this incredible history. Even the club didn't know what they had. They really didn't know what the history, all the members knew only the stories that sports writers told. So we started digging around. The advantage of that, one of the things that made it possible, was that because of the tournament, they had saved a huge amount of stuff. But they also had, you know, inside of, there would be file cabinets that they had stuff they didn't know they had. There'd be a stack of negatives from 1947. They found when they'd done a renovation of the dining room, and painters had found this roll of film that was stuffed into a crack, and there was blue paint on one side of it. It was an instructional film strip made by Bobby Jones in the, wow, you know, in the 1930s. So that all these things that they hadn't known anything about. It was great. It was like doing a PhD, but about it, really an actually interesting topic. And then on top of it, I got to play golf. And in the high point of the golf was in there are many high points, but here's two of them. One was my friends at home, I couldn't even tell them about it after a while about any of this, because they would just get so angry that they didn't, you know,
you'd be hit with a 9-iron on your head,
glaze over it. Right. But one of them said, how often do you get to play down there? And I said, well, I'll tell you, give you an example. There was one day when I was playing with three of the assistants from the golf shop, and another assistant was getting married, and there was going to be a party for him, an engagement party for him at 5 o'clock. And we realized at one point in the round that we were not going to have time to play all 18 holes. So we went directly from the 10th green to the 15th tee. And I said, in other words, we skipped Amen Corner, and none of us, we didn't think anything of it.
Wow.
And now they just, the blood drained from their faces. And but the highlight it was the Sunday before the 1998 Masters. It was at that time, I think they may have tightened it up a little, but members would, the week before the Masters, they would play. In the old days, members would play alongside tournament in the practice rounds. And Stevens told me that he thinks he's the reason that stopped, because he shanked a wedge shot into the crowd, and it's after that say, okay, no more members.
God.
But we, on Sunday, it was a great time to play, because there was, you know, their tour pros were playing the course. The course is almost in tournament condition. So on that Sunday, I played with, it was Lance Barrow, who was the CBS producer at the time, and we played Hootie Johnson, who was not yet the chairman, right, but was the next chairman, and then Jack Stevens' son Warren, who's a member now. So it was the Green Jackets against the media. We had a match, and Barrow and I were the media was losing. But then on 16, I birdied 16, and then I birdied 17, and then I eagled 18, and so I was 4 under on the last three holes. And I didn't know, you, when you play the 18th hole, the green is up high, you can't see it from the fairway. So I didn't know my ball had gone in. And I will say too, I hit 3-wood off the tee and pitching wedge into the hole. But
excuse me.
But Ernie Els and Lee Jansen were standing by the green. And they said, that ball went in. And so we had a celebratory beer with them. But anyway, I have that golf ball mounted on the club, sent me a little plaque with my
Get rid of that. And in the 90s, I mean, on TV, on a weekend, they wouldn't even show you the front nine. I mean, it would, you know, it would come on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you'd be, you know, on the 10th tee, basically. Nobody had any idea what the front nine looked like.
That's right. They started kind of sneaking it in. It was interesting. One of the interesting things that I discovered in that book, there was people always say, oh, the club, you know, they'll never let you see the other holes. The club for years fought CBS trying to get them to show more of the course. Yep. The first broadcast in the 1950s, wow. CBS only wanted to show the second shot on the 18th hole. Yeah. And they gave them money back to put in another transmitting station. They gradually pushed it back. The 12th hole, the great 12th hole, wasn't shown on TV until the 1970s. And the reason was CBS thought there was no reason. They didn't want to put that many cameras on the course. And the way the club tricked them into doing it was they let ABC was doing a Wide World of Sports special. Mm-hmm. And they let them do it about the 12th hole. So when the CBS guys came, there was an ABC banner right there on the course. And that CBS has always been the broadcaster of that tournament. But it's a one-year contract, and always has been. And that's kind of the way the club deals with providers. They have these long relationships, but every provider knows that it could end at any time. And mm-hmm. so they're always, you know, being careful. So anyway, the next year, the 12th hole was finally shown during the Masters broadcast.
Who is the pro there? They have a pro, a club pro at Augusta?
Yeah, they have two. And there were two then. It was Dave Spencer and Bob Klecki when I was working on my book. And Klecki had been the pro there, and Spencer was hired in the 60s to be his assistant. And Clifford Roberts, the legendary benevolent dictator, decided that he wanted to make them co-head pros at the club. And he called them into his suite, which is really just like a motel room, calls them into his room at the club. And he says, explains to them that he wants them to be co-pros. And he says, but I don't want Bob eating steak. He wants to keep them both at the club, but he doesn't want Bob eating steak and Dave eating hamburger. So he's going to make them co-pros. They'll have the same salary. And he says he also doesn't want them to be sort of scheming against each other. So if he ever has to fire either of them, he's going to fire them both. And they leave. Roberts was very intimidating, and everybody was just like, they were afraid of him. So they went out, and Klecki said, you know, I wasn't really planning to stay at the club. I want to go play on tour. And Spencer said, I wasn't planning to stay either. I'm from Iowa. I'm going to go back to Iowa and get a club job back in Iowa. And they said, and so Klecki said, well, you know, you're the assistant. You go tell Roberts that we're not going to do it. And Spencer said, you're the boss. You go tell Roberts. And they stood there silently for a moment. And then, they shook hands and said, okay, partner. And they were too scared to go talk to him to tell him they didn't want to do it. So they took the job, and they were there. They were partners for like, you know, 30 years, 40 right. years, exactly. You know, 40 years, I guess, you know, side by side, desk side by side in the golf shop. And then they have been succeeded by two guys who are assistants. It's the great job. I mean, Spencer's job, he was the head pro at Augusta National during the winter. And then during the summer, he was the head pro at Maidstone. So he had these, wow. you know, these two great, places that he went back and forth between. And meanwhile, it was Spencer who, it's the merchandise operation at the tournament. I mean, you've been and you see there's this amazing stuff. It's inexpensive. It's not like going to the Ryder Cup or the U.S. Open. The stuff is affordable. There's tons of it, and it's easy. You go in, they're constantly making it easier, so the line moves really fast. Anyway, it's I'm sure that on a per square foot per hour basis, it's the most successful retail operation anywhere in the world. And it was basically Spencer's creation, you know, doing it the way they do it.
Did you have a chance to visit the wine cellar?
Yes, it's amazing. It was a guy named Frank Carpenter who became the wine steward. Roberts, he'd been a, I don't know, he's a waiter there. Roberts told him he wanted him to be the wine steward, and that he should learn something about wine, and the way to do it would be to, you know, drink the wine and the cellar. And he became this sort of legendary, globally legendary wine steward. There was a Rothschild who came to play golf there, and he said, when he left, he said, as great as the golf course is, the wine cellar is greater, that kind of thing. So if Roberts was interested in you doing something, people tend to do it. There's a guy, one of my favorite guys there was a lawyer who was a member, and Roberts at some point decided that they needed another, he liked to have like a cardiologist and he liked to have the different professions represented because they might need them. And he decided that they were short on lawyers. And so he approached this guy, and the guy didn't play golf, and he had no connection to the club, but he said, I guess I'd better learn how to play golf, because there was really sort of no way to say no to Clifford Roberts. So he did. And then he became a happy golfer, and was a great guy. Really. He was one of my favorite people down there.
Listen to
it. I think also something else that people assume, well, they must've been, what was it like, you know, with those guys that they were the easiest people to work with. No one ever looked over my shoulder. Stevens told me at the beginning, he said, don't worry about anything. You can write whatever you like. And they read the manuscript, but they didn't ask me to change anything. And there were no restrictions on what I could do.
True? They just waved it through. It was like,
they read it. And Jim Armstrong, who was the general manager, had a suggestion about something. And I said, no, I really like to keep that. That was the way it was. And they were so relaxed about everything, and I was told, he said, you can talk to anybody you want to. And I did. I talked to members. I talked to guys who worked there. I talked to caddies. No one paid attention to where I was going. And it was great. Now, I think that I think that was very much at that club. The personality of the chairman is very much the personality of the club. And Stevens was a unique guy. And I don't think that since then, I don't think that I'm sure, I know for a fact that certainly wouldn't happen now. I mean, it was this perfect window of, they wouldn't have a journalist, you know, walking around with basically the run of the place now, just because it's different. It's also, it's become a very much bigger operation. I mean, they bought a whole neighborhood and tore down all the houses so that they could use it as a parking lot during the tournament. But, so it's kind of a bigger enterprise than it was then, as big as it was then.
And maybe we can get back to that topping, Mark, after the quick nine. But just a quick interjection. I listened to a great interview with Michael Caine today, and he was talking about the Rothschild, and you know, they make the Mouton, whatever, that red wine in Bordeaux, and he was an alcoholic. He wasn't allowed to drink it, so Michael Caine made it his mission to drink Rothschild's share of it. So just
that's good. What's it? Pitching in. That's nice.
Exactly. Mr. Horner, the quick nine.
Yeah, let's do some quick nine. Okay. Given that you've been working with pros, golf enthusiasts, writers since the 80s, you must have been told some truth along the way. So what's the most valuable golf tip you've ever received?
Oh, let's see. I heard one that somebody who pestered Jack, supposedly, pestered Jack Nicklaus for a golf tip. You know, just give me a golf tip. And he wouldn't, and then he finally said, all right, he said, wait, use the flat end of a tee to clean the crud from your spikes. They're back when people had spikes. Don't use the tip, use the flat end. So that was Nicklaus's tip. But now people don't have shoes like that, have golf shoes like anyone. The thing that I guess the breakthrough for me when I had my midlife makeover was we worked on really was my backswing, getting my swing path more inside to outside. And there was a tee, we were playing at a course in Scottsdale that was owned by my teacher, and there was a par three, elevated par three. It's like a 200 yard par three, beautiful hole way up high. And I hit my ball. It's a little weak, you know, slice toward the green. And he says, no, no. He says, you know, dude, what we were talking about, take it back, you know, bring your hands back inside, come back this way, really turn, really get a turn. And so I said, all right, you fucker, I'll show you. I'll really, so I like turned back so far I couldn't see the ball anymore. And I swung it. And I was thinking, ha ha, you know, I'll show you how good your advice is, you idiot. And as when I got back to where I couldn't see the ball anymore, I hear him say, great. And then I swung, and the ball was just like soaring high draw, higher than I've ever hit a ball. And it landed like 3 feet from the hole. And I thought, Jesus, why haven't I been doing this the whole time? And so that was like the breakthrough moment. So the best advice was to really, really, really swing, really take a backswing.
I'm going to stick with the beer draw hypothesis.
All right, David, you're going to die. We are all going to die. Who would you like to play your very last round with?
You know, I would play it. I've told people, and it's true, I would play it at my home club. It's a nine hole court with the guys that I play with there. In the 90s, we were the main competitive event at my club was a weekly weekend breakfast scramble. Yeah. And the guy, it was, you know, playing with old guy. It was the young guys, you did so much of the work. And as you did it, you know, you had to always be in play because you knew everybody else was not going to be. And you had, as you did this, carrying this whole group on your back, you had to endure, you know, a guy who can't play golf. Like, would you mind if I told you something about your putting stroke? You say, don't tell me anything. So anyway, we decided, let's start our own group. And so we started we would show up on Sunday morning and we made teams by pulling balls from a hat. And it, from that, it grew the regular Sunday men's group. Now this is, you know, 30 years later, we get 20, somewhere between 20 and 30 guys. We have numbered poker chips. We have our own scorecards. We play, and then the best thing is we take turns bringing lunch. Our club doesn't have a restaurant, which is the best thing about it. And so once a summer, you'll bring cheeseburgers and hot dogs and potato chips for 25 guys. And that's your obligation. And it's great. It's the greatest thing ever. And it's been going ever since. And I was looking around one day this summer. I was looking around, there like 25 guys there. It felt exactly the way it always had. It was like the same Sunday. We're eating lunch. And I looked around, I thought, you know, there are only two guys here who are originals, me and this guy who's almost 80. All the other guys are new, and yet it still feels the same. So I think it's one of the things that I like about golf. You have the sense that you're on a conveyor belt and there are guys falling off one end but more guys coming on at the other, and as long as you're riding up the belt, it kind of feels the same. And then, you know, then it's nice. I think it kind of it's people that they've got. We have teenagers, we had a guy in his 90s, and everybody's a pal. And it, the great thing about the handicap system in golf is that it makes it possible to have a competition like that. So where I would play my last round at my home club with the guys that I play every Sunday.
What's the name of that club?
It's called Washington Golf Club. It's a little nine-hole course. It's one of the, amazingly, it's one of the very oldest continuously functioning golf clubs in the United States. It was founded in 1889 on a different piece of property, but it's been on the one it's on now for 125 years. And
the story reminded me of when I used to go up like two or three times a year to Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know,
Van Cortlandt is a little younger. It was founded in 1896, I think. It's the oldest public golf course in the United States. Right. Van Cortlandt is great. It's great. And it's got this great clubhouse.
It's the same kind of things, you know, groups of 10 guys, 12 guys, whatever, you know. Yeah, great.
That's great. So anyway, I love it. And did you know that Van Cortlandt once, there's, it's kind of got chopped up by some parkways that went through.
Yeah, yeah.
Some and higher construction
there. I mean, there's, you know,
there's a little cluster of holes across a throughway. There in the 60s, people went skiing there. It was a little ski run, a little rope tow. Yeah. People would go skiing there. So
New York. I think you can read about that club event, that weekly club event, in Hit and Hope. How the rest of
that's right. Yeah, Yep. And it's, you can
also available still in Germany or with the major book resellers, and
everything's available.
Order it today, get it tomorrow. All right,
we do a good thing, which is when we have ties, we play them off, but nobody wants to go out on the golf course to play more golf to play it off. So we play all the playoffs are right around where we have lunch, right around the practice screen. Right. And we had, you know, one time we backed one of the guy's pickup trucks up to the fence. It had a sort of a plastic liner in the back. And so it was lob shots from the liner of the pickup truck onto the practice screen.
Cross golf.
Another time we hit a lob shot to the practice screen from inside the bag room on a little, like a soft drink top, teed it up on that, had to hit it through the door, over the first tee, over a fence onto the practice screen. Where we have throw them up onto the roof and they come down. We had once it was the wrong-handed overhand throw, so you had to kind of make a girl throw onto the, and we'd videotaped it so we could show everyone what everyone looked like.
This is what
it's great.
This is what I miss.
Yeah, that's what we're looking for. Okay, what would you be if you hadn't decided to write or to become a writer?
Oh, I think I maybe would have been a carpenter. One of my favorite, before I found golf, I found home improvement. And my wife and I bought, when we moved out of the city, we bought a 200 plus year old house, and it was a mess. And I suddenly, when I was a kid, my friends and I, we'd build clubhouses and we'd steal lumber from construction sites and build forts for ourselves. I suddenly realized, you know, I said, like, being a grown-up is even better than being a kid because you have more money in a car. So I think, you know,
the machines,
I don't have to steal lumber now. I can go buy it. I have this whole house that I can play with. I can buy all these power tools. And so I did. And so I did a lot of work on the house, and then, you know, was able to, we hired people to do a lot of it too. And I would watch what they did. And then when they would go home at night, I would sneak in and use their tools to do things. And one of the things I discovered is that we learn by doing, but you know, it's learned by experience. But unfortunately, what you learn from experience is the knowledge that you should have had before trying it in the first place. So by the time I finished many of my projects in the house, I knew how to do whatever it was, but it was too late. But it was really fun. And the thing that I like about that, it's different from writing, is that, you know, at the end of the day, there's concrete, visible, physical results of what you've done. You can see it. Yeah. And it was immensely satisfying. And as I was doing all that, I mean, that I would, if I suddenly found myself with 10 minutes before dinner, I would run up and, you know, like, use my miter saw to make some cuts. I thought, God, I've never done that with writing. I've never run to my office to write a paragraph before, because I had 10 minutes before dinner. So,
against all odds, you have won the senior club championship
at Washington. I forgot that. Right?
You and your mates decide to celebrate at a karaoke club. What's the first? Yeah, I love that chuckle. What's the first song you're going to sing, and how will you close the night?
Oh well, I will say I did win the senior club championship, and I also won the championship, and I won the handicap club championship. So we went to a karaoke bar. The member guest. So we have those. I have my four majors. I just wouldn't do it when I was in elementary school. Our music teacher asked me when I was in, I don't know, first grade, in music programs, to mouth the words, not to sing. And so I did. So all through, and then when I got to be in about eighth grade, I could be on stage group, but no sound ever came from my mouth in any of our music programs. And now I think similarly, when I turned 30, I decided I was never going to dance again. And so I'm like, at weddings, you know, I didn't dance at either of my children's weddings. They somehow got away with not doing that. And I have a friend who's even more that way than I am. And he said his girlfriend told me that if she's like, You know, if they have to go to the bank to get some money at the ATM, he'll say, "There's not going to be dancing, is there?" So he's even more terrified by dancing than I am. Old people don't look good when they.
Can we really let that happen, Frank?
No.
Okay.
You know why, David?
Not going anywhere.
We have a playlist on Spotify. That's why. And Ben Crenshaw came up with two songs.
The song. Ben took at least a minute of silence.
We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that one last, and I'll give me time to think of a song.
All right. Okay. Do you sometimes dream of golf? And if yes. Are they nightmares? Are they good dreams? Do you recall them? Would you share them?
Yes, and I write a little bit about them in one of the books. They're all golf dreams are all the same, and I wrote about this in Golf Digest maybe, and I heard from people. I said exactly that's what mine are like. But it's always I'm playing golf with somebody, and the first tee is somehow it's like a crowded. Somebody's garage filled with furniture, and the tee is a leather chair that doesn't quite have enough room to stand on, and the ball won't stay in one place, and you have to hit it. And then the green is like 200 yards away, and there are cars parked all around it. And then suddenly I'm on my hands and knees crawling around near the green, studying it to see if that's going to help me with my shot. They're all like that, always like that. And I don't know why that is. And I heard from people write to me and they say, it's always like that. I'm playing golf and I can't, you know, find a place to stand still. I have to stand on the hood of a car or something like that. And I don't know what, it's probably a sexual thing. I have no idea, but all my golf dreams are like that. And I complained once to a friend of mine who we played together when we were learning. I complained to him and I said, well, you think that, you know, it's a dream for God's sake, you know, couldn't we, like be playing Pine Valley or something like that. He said, I know it's free. You know, what's the deal? Why does it have to be this frustrating experience? Even more frustrating than actual golf, but that's the way it is.
What's the most horrendous thing that's ever happened to you on a golf course?
It was a great thing until it sort of turned wrong. This regular Sunday group that I have, we decided that we would have a sleepover. This was back before I quit drinking. We decided we would have a sleepover. And so there's 20 of us. And we came on Saturday afternoon. We came and
grown men having a sleepover.
We yes. came to the course on Saturday afternoon. We played 18 holes. We grilled steaks in the parking lot. I built a grill in the parking lot. We grilled steaks. We had a putting contest until it turned dark. And then when it was dark, we played night golf with glowing balls in the dark, and then at about midnight we started playing poker, and then we all went to sleep mostly in our cars because everybody snores. So the original idea was we're all going to just sack out in sleeping bags in the clubhouse, but that was impossible. It was too much noise, so everybody's sleeping in their cars. And then in the morning we awaken to the smell of bacon frying on this campfire in the parking lot, and we played golf again. We played our regular Sunday morning game, and I slept in my wife's in my minivan. I had taken the seats out and filled the back with cushions from the couch in our porch. It's the most comfortable bed I've ever slept in. It was fantastic. I couldn't believe it. And in the morning I woke up, I sat up in the bed, and I looked out, and there was another minivan that just pulled in next to my car. And it was a mother dropping off like her 10-year-old to caddy, to be one of our caddies. And I slowly lay back down because I thought, God, what does this look like? But the reason that was different, we got in trouble for that. Plus another day that same summer when four of us, it was a hot July day. It was very hot. We played the Sunday morning game, and then we decided to keep playing. There was some big, those gigantic bottles of wine in the refrigerator in the clubhouse, and we drank those, and we got drunk. And we finally said, let's swim in the water hazard on the fourth hole. So we stripped down to our underpants, we all dove in. It was great. It was fantastic.
Great.
And the lucky thing is that this was before YouTube or anything like that. So there's no online record.
No evidence.
But But four of us that we were in, we almost got thrown out of the club, and I had to write a letter of apology. I was the chairman of the golf club at the time.
From your mother.
I had to write a letter of apology to the entire club. The board of governors made me do it. And so the good thing about that was that people thought it was a joke.
Let's do that, Mark. Let's do exactly
that. Sorry about that. That's all right. Anyway, people thought it was a joke. So that was okay.
Let's do a weekend like that.
That's a brilliant story.
We'll have a David Owen festival.
Yeah, we'll have the European David
Owen. The David Owen festival. David, you know what's really funny? Mark owns a minivan.
Oh, you can sleep in my van if you want to.
I believe I have.
Yeah. Okay. Very quick answers, please.
Okay.
Beer on the course. You've already said yes and no. Yes. Right. Music on the range. Yep.
I don't mind it. It's older people, because older people complain about it, I decided not to.
Please.
I have to take this. Sorry.
Absolutely.
Can we pause for a minute?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
So the younger guys often do, and I remember the hearing a cell phone ring on the golf course, and I was so angry. I was, who the fuck is that? And then I realized it was my cell phone. No one had ever called me on it before. I didn't recognize the ring because I'd never heard it before. But I don't, you know, now it's like you might as complain about something else. It's hopeless. And I don't mind music. I would prefer not, because I think sort of people drift off. One of the things that I like about golf is that you're isolated from everything. And my wife once said, you know, what do you, I played with my brother. What did you guys talk about? You know, it's like the only time we see each other. I said, oh, I don't know, our swings. and I think women and men imagine that we're talking about them or talking about our children or something like that.
Not
and like
talking a lot at all.
A lot of the guys I play with, I don't even know what they do for a living. You know, who cares? Or that whether they're married or not. And it's just like you talk about golf and I think women, it's when they're together being friends, is much more about interaction. Men is more kind of parallel play. And you support each other just by, you know, by playing together. And that's it accomplishes the same thing, but it doesn't look the same if that's not the way you handle your relationship. So ideally nobody would, there would be no devices other than rangefinders, but it's just at this point, you know,
it's men loving men, like Michael Murphy had Agatha McNaughton say.
Yeah, that's right. What she said. I think we can both guess. Do you want to answer for David on the next question?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, first.
Is David going to... Yeah, it's a first, isn't it? Is David a walker or a rider?
He's definitely a walker.
All right. Does he warm up or not?
No.
No. The reason is no warm-up, not even putting practice. And the reason I started was I used to go to the range like anybody, and I gradually realized that, you know, the best shot I hit today was the first ball I hit on the driving range. And like the next one was a little bit worse. And then the next was a little bit worse. And then, so you do that. You hit a bucket of balls, each shot slightly worse. And then you start shanking it. And you're just like, shank, shank, shank. And then you go tee off. And it's like, why
is that? Why am I playing golf?
So, no. And we have kind of in my Sunday morning group, there's kind of a rule, no practice swings. So you step up the ball and you hit, and it's like it's much more efficient, I think. So yes, no practice, right. no warm up, no practice.
What's a gimme?
Oh, we have debated this. There's a group in Los Angeles, and they will tee off like 14, 15 at a time, and it's very well organized. They play faster than, you know, a normal foursome does. They have a guy who keeps track of everything in a ledger, and they have the gimme distance measured in tape, you know, let's say a ring of tape around the putter, so there's an agreed distance. And our agreed distance was I think it was the length of Bill Fairbairn's foot, and Fairbairn was a notorious putt taker. He's the kind of guy who, you know, this kind of guy who's got a 3 foot putt,
yeah,
which he misses. He hits it 6 feet anyway. Past. He hits it 6 feet past, and then he scoops up the 6 footer because, like, you know, he's. I made one go at it. The next one's good. So we also
What time
we
does
allow...
that? What time does that Sunday game tee off? What time you
7:30? 7:30 usually. Just whoever shows up. Yeah, and it's different. The teams are made at random. You can't. There's no. You know, I won't play with so and so. I played with a group that was very similar on Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, and the guy who ran that it was a nightmare for him all weekend because there's so many guys that said I won't play with him. I won't play with him. I won't play with him. And so he had to arrange all the foursomes ahead of time. But you play with the nice thing about it is by the end of the summer, you've played with everybody, and we have, you know, we'll see somebody who's a new member. Nobody knows who it is. Say, come play, show up on Sunday. Well, and by the end of a couple of weeks, they've met everybody.
Yep.
And it's great. I think that's what golf is good for. And I've been to rich guy clubs where, you know, there's Warren Stevens, who's the son of Jack Stevens. His club is called The Lotion. It's in Arkansas. It's beautiful. It's designed by Tom Fazio, and it's this great, great place. But they only allow about like 2 foursomes out a day. And so you go there with your 3 rich guests, and you stay in your little cottage, which is beautiful. It has perfect Wi-Fi, and you never have to leave. But there's none of this, you know, no interaction with other people. It's not a
club.
It's just kind of a screw you kind of experience rather than like, you know, in our group, there was a time when we had the richest guy in town and the guy who cut his grass, and the you know, you'd rather be the partner of the guy who cut his grass because he was a better putter. The great thing about golf is that all that, if you do it right, all that stuff goes away. The handicap system is sort of brilliant, and it's somehow it's kind of magically self-correcting. I mean, everybody knows that it's fake, but somehow if you're not getting enough strokes, you play a little bit better. And if you're getting too many, you manage to screw up holes that you must somewhere in the back of your mind feel guilty about. And it kind of works out. So golf is underappreciated by non-golfers. That's what I'll say.
Absolutely. Parkland or Lynx?
Lynx. In May, my brother and I and my agent and his brother are going off to play in Western Ireland. And I've taken many trips to Ireland and the UK. And we always play Lynx courses. And Lynx golf is the greatest.
Driver or putter?
Oh, I love my driver now. But I got senior shafts in all my clubs. But I think driver's always more fun to when you hit a driver well. Now, unfortunately, I think that the longest drive that anybody ever hits with a driver, it's similar to the driving range. It's the first shot you hit with it. Yeah. No, it's just you buy a new driver, the first drive you hit with it, you'll never hit one as long as that.
Exactly.
That's it. You're done. You might as well get a new driver every time you play.
Are you an equipment buff? Do you like going out and buying new equipment, or is it just like I play a used driver I bought a few years back? I think Frank, yours is probably an old timer already, isn't it? Or not quite, but it's, you know, okay. All right. No, I know, but it's you know, it's not the newest.
So. Yeah, no, my clubs are 10, 12 years old. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You know, I played the TaylorMade R9. The first time I hit him, I thought to myself, these should be illegal. I mean, you talked about that towering 7-iron or something. I never hit a ball like that. I'm like, Jesus. So in the end, but I mean, I'm sure you have them in those 20 guys that you play with, those equipment whores that have to get the latest driver every 6 months. But I can't see David being that kind of guy.
No, I'll kind of stick with, but I've gone through a couple of revolutions in my golf clubs. One was discovering it was in very early when I was playing. I played with a guy who had a Callaway 7-wood, which was brand new, the brand new Heavenwood.
Yeah.
And it was it was an amazing golf club. And so I had all the high numbered Callaways, you know, the 9-wood, the 13-wood, the 11-wood, all that kind of stuff. And they were great. And then, but then hybrids, a friend of mine got a, it was a, Nike made a hybrid called a Slingshot. Yeah. And he said, here, try this club. I said, try this club. And I went, Jesus, this is great. And so we both switched to all Nike hybrids. And then they got the next version, which was the also Nike Sumo. And I played with those for about 20 years. And I loved them. But now I have brand new Callaway hybrid, all hybrids. I don't, my longest iron is a 9-iron. Hybrids are great. I think hybrids are great. They all have senior shafts and I love them.
That was in What's in the Bag with David Owen.
Yeah, that was great, actually. 20-year-old clubs. I've got one.
My longest iron is a 9-iron. I'm going to write that.
I've got one question incorporating one of Frank's favorite German words. If I were to use the word flight, what would you associate it with in golf terms?
Oh, now I'm thinking about an airplane flight from New York to Shannon for this island trip we're going to take. But there's so many applications in golf. Your flight from your home, from your domestic situation, to the golf course to play golf.
The flight, the Flucht von zu Hause.
The flight. It is. You will laugh. It is a German word for a golf group. They use it. They write. It's an English word. They use the English word. They use the English spelling. But it's basically a group of golfers.
Right. Well, in a golf tournament, you play in your. There are different flights. A flighted golf tournament.
A flight, so B flight, C flight.
The championship flight. And, exactly. Yeah, it must all be. Our languages are closely related, so
they are.
Must be.
What's the hardest course you've ever played on?
Oh, the hard Oakmont. The great, great course that I have no desire to ever play again. And what it was during that assignment from Golf Digest in 94, I hadn't been playing golf for very long. I played all the top 10 and I watched a film of Oakmont. It was during the Open, Ernie Els won. The guys would hit their drives and they would bounce, like they would roll like another 100 yards down the fairway, down the boom, 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 boom. And when I played, it had been raining for, I don't know, for 40 days and
40 nights. Drive,
it would hit a drive. It was still raining. It would hit a drive. It wouldn't go very far. And then it would land and it would just plug. So the course it was not playing as long as it had, or as short as it had in the US Open. So it was endless and it was miserable. And then but the greens were still just as fast. And the thing they always say at Oakmont is, oh, you think the greens are fast for the U.S. Open? You should see them during the member guest. But it was true, and you'd see members. They all had twitches like this. You know, the putting was so hard on their nerves, and the 18th green, the back of the 18th green is the practice green. So as you play the 18th hole, you see all these guys back there just with nervous disorders caused by playing that golf course all the time.
Yeah, I mean, whatever the top 100 lists, whatever those lists are that are made by Golf Digest, among other people, doesn't it seem like always like the top 10 are like the top most difficult courses? I mean, does a good golf course have to be difficult? I mean, I read you writing about Pine Valley, which, is 6,500, 6,600 yards from all the way back. With fairways, as wide as football fields sideways. Does a good golf course have to be hard?
You know, that list used to be called the 100 hardest when Golf Digest first did it. And there is this idea that, if you really want a test, somebody with golfers, I go, what'd you think of that golf course? I go, oh, it wasn't much of a test. I go, oh, you eagled every hole? Well, no, I shot, 80, but it wasn't much of a test. And I played the TPC at Sawgrass. This was on another Golf Digest assignment. And I went down and I played it first from as far forward as you could go. In its shortest possible configuration. It was great. It was so much fun. It was tremendous. It was really pleasant day. And then the next day I played it from the tournament tees, which are like 9 million yards. And I played with a guy who, played on some he wasn't a tour player, but he played at that level and played in college. I played with these couple of guys who were so much longer than I was, and there were holes where I couldn't even get to the fairway from the tee. I couldn't even get to the trouble in front of the fairway from the tee, because like there would be water, and you tee, and there'd be water, and then there'd be a bunker, and then there'd be rough, and then there'd be the fairway, and I was just trying to get it into the bunker next to the water, and I couldn't even get there. So it was, you know, I think everybody's golf course, generally, except for the tour pros, their course is too long for them. It's too hard for them.
Yeah.
And golf is much more fun. But the course that I play at home, it's not even 6,000 yards long, but it's challenging. It plays longer. It's challenging. But, you know, men can play it, children can play it, women can play it. I can compete with a college player when I won the club championship, I beat a kid who was in college and playing for a Division I college team. I never would have had a chance against him on a 7,500 yard course, but on a short, tight course, you know, an older guy who doesn't hit it a million miles has a chance. And so I think that, you know, the obsession with link too. And you look at the courses that they play, the guys play on tour. You look at how much of that course is maintained for no reason. The first 300 yards, all just ball of every hole, the ball flies over it, and that's it. Why did they bother to mow it? golf, you know, if the focus in golf were on accuracy rather than on distance, you could, it would kind of solve the equipment problem. It wouldn't do you any good to be hitting it 400 yards.
You just mentioned equipment, and this is one of my last questions. What's the worst piece of golfing equipment you've ever bought?
It was called the Medicus. You remember, it's a hinge practice club. And
The one that sort of bends itself when you're too fast.
Or if you make a bad swing,
and it goes in.
But if you make a good swing, it's perfect. And I was complaining about it to my brother. I said, I paid $100 for this. It's the stupidest piece of shit. There's no way. There's nothing you can do it. You can't hit it. And he looks at it like this. He takes it. It hits this beautiful high sort of. Cool. So it just. So that was the worst thing I've ever bought.
I know you've written a piece about Liv. Do you think that Liv Golf, this is the end of the Quick Nine, do you think that Liv Golf has a future? Because they have secured a TV deal. It looks like they'll be playing a full schedule sort of like this year. Loads of courses beginning with the word Trump on that.
Right.
Loads of them. Trump Bedminster, Trump this, Trump that. I was surprised they weren't playing Trump Doomberg and Trump whatever, you know.
Maybe
now. Do they have a future? Do you think there's a future there?
I don't know. That, you know, just throw so much money at those guys. I didn't like it. And I also, I think psychologically, you know, if you're a golf fan, any sports fan, it's fantasy. There's a fantasy element to it. And you kind of have to believe that the guys care about what they're doing, that they want to end up in the record book, and that they want to be, you know, that it means something to them when they're playing a big tournament. And I think that's one of the keys to the Masters, is that that sort of makes everybody believe that this green jacket is the most important thing in the world, and that's what they're all thinking about. And Liv, just to, you know, you hear the announcers, all they talk about is the money, and it's creepy. And I went from thinking, it kind of changed the way I thought about all those guys. I don't think in my mind, at least, Phil Mickelson's reputation will ever recover. It's hard. There's one of my New Yorker colleagues described him as, he looks so beaten up. He said he looked like a divorced dad, which is what he does look like. And then, you know, it's just his black suit and his down face and his bloodshot eyes. I find it not only do I not like it, but it makes me not like the PGA Tour as much as I did before, just because it's like it cracks open a door on professional golf that
lets the light shine out.
Better off if it had kept closed.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens. It's the Saudis have so much money that it doesn't matter to them. And I think they're probably what they're caring about is building a sort of Dubai-like reputation as a golf destination, tourist destination, and exactly. Who knows what they, if they even have a rational way of thinking. It's just funny money to them. And well, I can see why, you know, if you know, somebody offers you $50 million, you think, oh, all right, I'll take it. And
what do I have to do?
Right. I mean, it's lucky that they haven't offered it to, you know, what would it take to buy off a Golf Digest writer? It wouldn't be $50 million, but it wouldn't be that much. So it's just as well that they don't care about any of that.
I think they're paying Fairty.
Pardon me?
Do we know what they're paying?
Oh, we don't. That disappointed me too, and I love Fairty.
Yeah, I really love the guy.
Charles Barkley said a good thing, which he says, you know, he said, if you play professional sports, all the money's kind of dirty. And that's right. But still, you know, if you're a sports fan, you know, yeah, it's just you just kind of have to believe that they're in it for something more than that. And once they reveal that they're not, it's hard to look at them the same way.
I think it was Kyle Porter who said on this show that he hasn't heard one good reason why anybody would go there, you know. So that made a lot of sense to me. Today, you know, there was the big showdown between Rory and Patrick Reed in Dubai. I don't know if you saw it.
He won on the last hole.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty tense, but you know, Reed was apparently at it again yesterday with some bogus rulings. But are you a football fan, David?
Yes, I almost had a heart attack last night. I'm from Kansas City, so I was watching.
Oh, you're from Kansas City. There you go. There was some bad press about the umpire there. At what point does Terry Bradshaw need assisted walking?
Right, exactly. Now, it was funny. I was watching with a friend of mine. I grew up with in Kansas City. My best friend. We were born on the same day, Kansas City. Best friends from sixth grade on. Anyway, he was complaining about the officials, but he thought they were going out of their way to rule against Kansas City, but then suddenly it turned and they seem to be compensating for it by, this is kind of comparable to golf, where now it used to be the refs would make a decision. They made bad decisions. They made good decisions and you just moved on. Everybody made mistakes. Sometimes they did. It was obvious and moved on. Now they have this, you know, like super slow-mo and they're trying to decide whether did the ball touch the ground as he went down. And I would personally rather go back to just letting people make mistakes. And then, cause they, you know, in time they average out.
I agree. And in your book, you write about it, how golf is the only sport where you're your own referee. Really, you know, I mean, you know, if you look at baseball or something where it's encouraged to frame a pitch, or in basketball where when the clock's running down, you break the rules, you foul somebody to stop the clock. You know, yeah. I mean, those are all things that are that in golf, at least. And I think you put it in a way. Well, at least it's supposed to be that way. You know,
right. No, we have cheaters in golf, but But you see in a football game, too, where. The receiver knows that he hasn't really caught the pass.
But
he tries to cover it up, and then he gets up and then let's snap the ball up quick so they can't review it. And in golf, you know, you would have to I didn't catch it.
Exactly. I mean, in soccer, as you guys call it, you know, you're a hero for getting a penalty. Yeah. Yeah, right. You know, so it's very interesting. I think. Can we get quickly back to the Masters a little bit, Mark?
Oh yes, please.
Because I want, you know, and everybody loves the Masters. Everybody know, you know. I mean, everybody knows the back nine of Augusta and all this. Even here in Germany, people. But I love the Masters and I love the golf course and everything about it, but there's also some things that are maybe not so pleasant. For one, I think you know, people who are not really golfers, let me put it that way, they expect their home courses to be perfectly manicured like Augusta. Just because they see it on TV, this blue water and everything, and they're like, oh, my course is, you know, what is this? There's a pitch mark on the green. That's one thing. But the other thing really is Clifford Roberts. And if I remember correctly, he at one point said that as long as I'm alive, the golfers will be white and the caddies will be black.
Yeah, I don't think he really said that. I mean, this is one of the things I write about in my book. That this, I think, that belongs in the sort of this galaxy of sports writer stories that sports writers tell each other. Mm-hmm. If you go back and look through the you know, golf has a terrible history of racism and still does. But yeah, the stories that are usually told about Augusta National are not true. For example, it will be told that you know, the club purposely did not invite black golfers to play in the tournament, which is not true. They, unlike the PGA of America, for example, the Masters had published qualifications to get in, and nobody who qualified was ever denied an invitation to the tournament. What's more, as it became, steadily through the years, those modifications, the requirements were changed, were modified. And in the period when people were talking, why are there not black golfers in golf? They steadily were modified on purpose, making it more likely that black golfers would qualify, not less. And so, for example, the fewer spots were reserved for winners of past major tournaments who were at that point entirely white. Golfers were given a chance, professionals were past winners that were given a chance to vote for players not otherwise qualified, who would be invited if they were voted for. And Art Wall was in all those years, Art Wall was the only pro who voted, who nominated a black golfer. Mm-hmm. The qualifications, if you had won a PGA Tour event, you would automatically qualify. That was added in 1972, when it was clear that black golfers were going to win those tournaments and would therefore qualify. It was an added, knowing that would be one of the consequences of it. Robert said, and it was true, that golf was poorer, the Masters was poorer for never having had a black participant, and he looked forward to the day when he would. And then when Lee Elder did qualify and had to endure that whole year, the club worked hard Roberts brought him to the club ahead of, a member brought him to the club ahead of time and allowed him to. So I think that a lot of the criticism, that a lot of the things that are said about the Masters are said only because it's said in the South. And it's kind of, if you're a sports writer, you annually, it's kind of like going to church once a year. You take a position against the Masters, and that's how you stake out your position on race, by talking about the Masters. The thing that I said, the whitest organization on the grounds of the Augusta National during the tournament is the Golf Writers Association. You go into the press building, it's entirely white. The Augusta National had more black members than, I think, almost, you know, certainly more than the Golf Writers Association of America did.
We talked last week about that with Petra Himmel, who has been at the Masters for a German journalist who's been there for 21 years, and there's no women in the press, and there's me and one woman.
Yeah, right. No, it's fair. So I think that it's golf that sucks in terms of race, and it has to do, and you know, the PGA of America, which sponsors the PGA tournament and the Ryder Cup, until the 1960s, when a court in California made it stop, it explicitly in its constitution said that all members of the PGA of America had to be Caucasian. It was a rule, and I think it was California said, you won't be able to have any tournaments in our state as long as you have, and that the PGA of America reluctantly. Nicklaus never spoke out against it. Palmer never spoke out against it. It was decided in the courts, and it changed. And so, but nobody ever said at the PGA every year, people don't say, well, you know, until 1967 or whatever it was, you couldn't be black and be a member of the PGA of America. It's all of golf's conscience cleansing is focused on the Masters. And I think, you know, because it's in the South. And as I say, the golf has a lot to be ashamed of, but it's not. It's the focus on the Masters is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it fascinating. One thing I didn't know was that until I guess it was in the 70s or 80s, the competitors weren't allowed to bring their own caddies. They had to use caddies from the club.
Oh, That was true. It was true in golf generally, and it was probably had. Golfers didn't have their own caddies. And I reading about the. I was talking to. It was the U.S. Open at Wingfoot in '74, and I was talking to a guy who's a member there now who got to caddy for. He caddied for Nicklaus in a practice round and for somebody else in the tournament. And then you went and you the players went and they signed in and they drew a caddy from. The caddies were often kids who were members of the club or members of the club and things like that. And I'm sure there were racist and socioeconomic reasons for not wanting caddies from lowlifes from other parts of the country showing up. But that was standard of golf. It was preserved. The requirement that local caddies be used was preserved at Augusta National longer than elsewhere, because if you were a caddy at Augusta National, that was like, that made your year, caddying for somebody at the Masters. And also it was a course that hugely rewarded local knowledge. So there's still, when Ben Crenshaw won, he played with an Augusta caddy with Carl Edwards, who was Roberts withstood pressure. Or the club withstood pressure from outside for a long time to preserve, for the purpose of preserving this huge. It was like an investment banker getting an annual bonus. This was the big payday for those guys. It was caddying during the tournament. And it made them kind of celebrities in town. But then golf changed, and when golf got to be big money, guys would travel. They would. You had a caddy that you traveled with, and then they wanted to play with them. In those tournaments too. But you'd see, like, when Watson had a regular caddy when he was winning all his Open championships, but he would always play with Scottish caddies when he was.
There's a great documentary called Looper, where you get to meet loads of these Augusta National caddies.
Some of them are fantastic. Caddies that I played with there were still some. Now caddying, even club caddying, has become you can make a living at it. And for example, they're at Bandon Dunes, there are guys who caddy there during their season, and then they go to New Zealand and caddy during the New Zealand season, because there's this relationship between Julian Robertson's courses in New Zealand and the Bandon courses. Mm-hmm. And so you see, even now, like, you see guys who caddy at Augusta National, it's not local guys, but they're guys who played really well in college, maybe even on tour.
Tom Doe, right?
Bandon. They're incredibly good. There were still the old caddies from the old days, still some great old caddy stories from the past. And a caddy I had, the most amazing thing I saw a caddy do there was a guy who'd been a caddy there for a long time. And you know what, those greens are super hard, super slick. And my ball had made a ball mark, and he fixed it with my pitching wedge. He just walked up to him, just a bing, 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 like this. And it was perfectly smooth. And I had no idea how he did it.
Did you and Tom Watson have the same first grade teacher?
We did. We did. We went to the same. He actually came. I don't think he was there in first grade, but we had the same teacher later. I think he didn't come. I think I learned later that he didn't come until fifth. But I remember him. He was a running quarterback on a really good football team, and he was a shooting guard on a really
Kansas
good
basketball City. He was from Kansas City, right?
Yeah, from Kansas City, and this is something else that's changed in sports. He was a three-letter guy. He played football. He played basketball. When two-a-day football practices started in August, he hung up his golf clubs and didn't touch them again until the spring. And I think part of the reason that he was so good at golf was he used different muscles during these different sports he never burned out on golf. In fact, when he went to Stanford, he didn't.
One of the few Democrats on the PGA Tour, huh?
Yeah, if he still is, I don't know. A lot of I don't know if there's even one now.
I don't think
Brad Faxon. Duval maybe.
Duval.
And look what happened to him. It doesn't help him. Yeah, they're all. It's really.
But just,
it's
but really just about depressing. The Masters. And I find it fascinating what you say, because you know so much about the place. Now, when you watch it, I mean, they are always on the cutting edge. Even before that live thing started, they're on the cutting edge of the broadcast. They got now these shots where you see the undulations of the green. Their website is and their app is number one. I mean, you know,
amazing.
So
you go back, you know, on that website, you can watch every shot, yeah, exactly. Video of every exactly. Shot that every golfer hits.
Yeah.
And the reason they do it, they've always been, it's kind of, people think that they're sort of stuffy and staid.
Right.
You know, IBM will come to them and say, we want it
for golf. Didn't they invent color television for golf?
No, was but what they did do was they were basically the reason that CBS went to color broadcasting, because they were going to switch to NBC was ahead, the Peacock. They were ahead on color, and CBS, Roberts wanted and Jones wanted the Masters to be broadcast in color, and CBS had all these excuses. They finally, when they realized that they were going to lose, when the Miss America pageant was shown on NBC in color, then Roberts and Jones decided they were going to put their foot down. Jones had this idea of they would skip television broadcast altogether. They would treat it like the way boxing matches sometimes. You would show it in theaters, live in theaters on a big screen in color, and show it that way. They had all these ideas of how they would, what if CBS really dug in its heels, what they would do to get it in color. And there are these wonderful films of color films of the Masters back to, I can't remember when the first one was, in the 50s, but they were worried that it was because because of dissatisfaction they had with the television broadcast, that they made a separate record. And it's great. Those films are great. You go back and watch, you know, narrated by Chris Schenkel, and they're, you know, they're fantastic, but it was a completely separate crew. It's not the television footage. It's a different crew, a different director. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of a parallel record of, you know, in the old days, networks didn't even necessarily save recordings of shows. They didn't save kinescopes of shows. So there's only partial record of the first Masters broadcast. There's not, you know, you think, well, you'd be able to just go on YouTube and watch it, but you can't.
Yeah. But you can watch, you can watch every final round whenever on YouTube. I mean, 6 hours, and I've done not all of them, but a lot of them.
I was going to say is that the club has always been very open to anything that network wanted to try, anything that IBM wanted to try. Their part, that whole the masters.org website with all those the shot by shot stuff.
Well, even the fact that they limited the commercials during the broadcast.
Right.
I mean, it was like the one sporting event that had no commercial or hardly any commercials.
No, it's true. It's this tiny, tiny little bit. It was when they realized that they could make that as a condition. And it's interesting because it puts a huge pressure on the producer of that broadcast, because you never get a chance to catch your breath. It's really amazing. I talked to Lance Barrow about this. It was how they make it sound like a story that's unfolding. As you watch it, it feels like a story that's unfolding. But you think of it, it's just all this random stuff that's happening simultaneously. And they never get a chance with commercials to stop and kind of think mm-hmm. about what's happening. And yet they make it seem like a narrative. It's a remarkable skill. I would think of the pressure of being in the control booth.
I can't wait till April.
Yeah, right. No, so it's like the pandemic year when we had one in November and then again in April.
That's right. David Ogren last week picked a live player to win the Masters, by the way. We had him on live from the PGA show down in Orlando. And he's like our, if we're Saturday Night Live, he's our Steve Martin. David Ogren is here all the time.
That's great.
What a good guy he is. And that's what he said. He said a live guy will win. Remember that, Mark?
Yeah, but I don't believe it.
I don't know. Patrick Reed looked pretty good today, but I don't know. I'm hoping for Bernard.
Just don't want it to happen, you know.
Right. Now it's just better let them fade away.
Exactly. The wives. We got to talk about the wives playing golf.
Okay.
But just quickly, I'm so happy my wife doesn't play golf, because I don't want to play with her. She doesn't. She wouldn't understand. Mark, does your wife play?
My wife traveled the world with me, even playing golf.
And, do you like playing golf with your wife?
The moment she was expecting our son, well, not the moment she was expecting, but after a few months, she just took the opportunity and said, like, this is over for me. And she has hardly touched a club since then. She's just a perfectionist. She wants the things to be as perfect as possible. And if she can't make them work the way she wants them to be, she will have none of that.
Women are not going to pick up. They're going to putt for a 12.
She has done that, yes. And I think if you can't accept the fact that it's not always your fault, and that, you know, then, and if you can't accept the fact that it's gonna, you know, if you can't accept golf, you shouldn't try. You know, if you think you can control it, you should rather, you know,
men loving men, that's what it is.
Yeah, do something else.
It's something I wrote about bridge, but I also like to play bridge, which is sort of indoor golf. It's not, it's also a foursome, and it has many similarities, and it fits very well with golf because you can play it, you know, when you can't play golf.
Nice.
But they're similar in that with both of them, you have to be willing to be bad at them for a really long time. Anybody who takes up golf and thinks it, who has, gets frustrated by hitting bad shots, they'll never last. And so it is an interesting personality when someone who's, you know, when you see them doing, I'm really bad at this, I'm terrible at it, and I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep doing this for years, even though, you know,
and I enjoy doing it. Ooh,
yeah, and I love, yeah, right. It's very interesting because, and it's just because every once in a while you hit a good shot, and then it's like a little dose of some drug, and you want to keep doing it.
That was fantastic.
Well, this has been a great experience. I enjoyed it thoroughly as a fan of going way back to the early 80s of Harper's and Esquire and The Atlantic and those publications. You know, I asked Mark today, what are we going to talk to him about? And he says, there's plenty of stuff. And obviously there's plenty of stuff. There's plenty of stuff for more. So thank you very much for taking the time, David. I actually signed up for the New Yorker just because of you. I got 30 emails in the last 12 hours from them just for giving them my email so I can read your column. But I enjoy it thoroughly, and the book that I just finished, My Usual Game, I highly recommend it, also to our German friends. It's an easy read, and I mean that in a good way. He is, now I understand why you are one of the 50 funniest writers, like Borowitz said. did he say which number you were, or were you just somewhere?
Oh, yeah, I should ask him.
Where in mid-30s.
Yeah, right. What's my handicap?
There you go.
The list of funny writers.
There you go. Mark, take us home.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was a Golf Show edition with David Owen. My name's Mark Hogner.
And I'm Frank Forster.
To the Linksland.